Hello and welcome to The Libertarian, a production of Defining Ideas for the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, joined, as always, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, the Peter and Kirsten Bedford Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, Professor of Law at the NYU School of Law, and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, gay marriage and the Supreme Court, and we are taping this within a few hours of oral arguments before the court on the Defense of Marriage Act, and the day after arguments over Proposition 8. So, Richard, let's start there with Prop 8. This is the state constitutional amendment out of California that banned gay marriage. The Supreme Court heard oral argument on that case yesterday, and a lot of the reportage has focused on a possible inclination, particularly from Justice Kennedy, to perhaps punt this case on standing grounds, which has to do with some of the complexities of the California initiative process. So describe the argument there as well as how you think it may or should play out.
Well, standing is always a mysterious topic, even in normal cases, but this one is peculiarly difficult. The first point to understand about standing is that the United States Supreme Court, in a case called Frothingham v. Mellon, decided some 90 years ago, ruled that fairly strongly that citizens and taxpayers do not have standing to challenge government actions on the grounds that they exceeded the scope of the constitutional power. And the basis of that particular argument was that they do not have a discrete pocketbook interest separate and apart from all other citizens, which allows them to come forward. The consequence of that decision in that context was that nobody could challenge the statute because the only people were hurt were this vast group of taxpayers. Usually, when you have a situation that nobody can challenge something because of concrete injury, the correct response, which the Supreme Court did not adopt on that occasion, is to let somebody act as the representative of the large disorganized class. So if you're a citizen, for example, in the state of New York in 1923, and there's something which is ultra-virus, its constitution, any citizen can sue in order to enjoin it because otherwise nothing is going to happen. And the whole bill will pass without having it vetted. So it's a kind of a repeal of Marbury and Madison. Well, this case is sort of on the opposite. What's happened is that the people who are in charge of administering the statute have declined to defend it. That includes the governor and the attorney general and so forth. And there's a parallel position at the federal government when the United States and the attorney general and the solicitor general don't want to defend DOMA either. So the question then is, does the fact that there is nobody to defend this statute mean that there is no litigation that you could have over it on the grounds that you haven't drawn into the case a proper party? So what happens in this particular case, self-appointed citizens who actually care about this thing said, well, we'll defend it. And given the fact that they're now in court and arguing this case for everything that they have, you have the following kind of irony. Do you throw the whole thing out because they're not proper parties in this case? At which point, the question then says, is, well, do you have to throw out the decision of Vaughn Walker or that of the Ninth Circuit because they may arguably subject to the same kinds of defects? At which point, Prop 8 stands? Or do you say that there's something peculiar about all of this going on at the Supreme Court so that Judge Walker's decision stands? And if it stands, does it stand for all of California or only for the District of San Francisco in which he decided the case? This is really very novel kinds of territory, and nobody's particularly sure what they're going to do. My own view about this is to be a bit more purposive and a little bit less technical. So the question I would ask myself is, do I think when they got Chuck Cooper to defend Prop 8, and when they got Paul Clement to defend DOMA, did we get ourselves a bunch of stragglers who don't know what they're doing, or did we get ourselves some fairly serious lawyers who are willing to put the case forward with a lot of energy? And that's a question which just answers itself. If those guys can't represent you in a Supreme Court case for a conservative cause, then in effect the movement is going to have to be silent. So if the purpose of standing is to make sure that there's a really well-argued, well-crafted dispute between parties who have a stake in the case, there could not be higher odds than in this circumstance. And to defer it under these circumstances to some other particular date means just who is going to have standing and how is that going to take place. If somebody is turned down for a marriage license as a gay couple, and it turns out that the administration in California refuses to defend it, are we back in the same problem again that we've had before? So I hope the Supreme Court rises above this stuff and gets down on the merits. It would be a massively anticlimactic decision, and it will create lots of recriminations without any real sense. I've never liked the standing doctrine. It has never been applied, as far as I can tell, in this way to defendants. The same issue arises with DOMA, where the House of Representatives on the Republican Party are coming forward. And if it turns out that the citizens in California who defend it don't have standing, well, probably the Republicans in Congress don't have standing because they don't have a special pocketbook interest either. Interesting stuff, but I don't think particularly edifying.
Now, we heard Justice Scalia yesterday asking some pointed questions about the contention that prohibiting gay marriage is a violation of equal protection, asking if that's the case, at what point did it become unconstitutional? So you anticipated this in your column for defining ideas on this topic. So how does the originalist case shake out here?
Well, I mean, that's, of course, exactly the right point that one wants to raise. If you're a Justice Scalia, you go back to the situation as it existed around 1868 when the Equal Protection and the Due Process Clause involving the states were passed, or back to 1791 when the Due Process Clause was passed in the Bill of Rights. And it's quite clear that essentially gay relationships were regarded as contemptible and criminal by everybody, anywhere, for every reason. So if you're trying to figure out whether or not there was a major transformation, the answer to that question has to be no, on the grounds that the earlier justices who looked at this thing in the late part of the 19th century got it right when they assumed that every general guarantee under the Constitution, whether it be religious on the one hand or equal protection on the other, is subject to this huge morals caveat where the state is given carte blanche with respect to sexual arrangements. That is the way in which they thought it. Now, do we mean exactly that? Because the other side of the question, which is equally obnoxious, is suppose somebody were to say, all right, Justice Scalia, now suppose the year is 1872, and some state legislature in a burst of Puritan holiness now decides to ban all marriages so that neither gay nor straight people can get married in their particular jurisdiction. Would you say that this was constitutional? And it is very clear when you go back and you read all the general accounts of liberty that those are always including the right to marry in accordance with the usages of the community in which the marriage starts to take place, which means essentially gay marriage out and ordinary traditional marriages are going to be in. So as I said in the column, the real difficulty for libertarians like myself is if we're honest about the tradition, it's not one that we embrace, but we have to respect it. But if we're thinking about this as a matter of liberty, then we have to say that the tradition is wrong. If you look constitutionally, essentially the earlier understanding of this is that the only kinds of liberties that were protected were those that were also traditional, so that under these circumstances, the advocates of gay marriage would lose and the folks trying to strike down DOMA would lose as well. I think that's what Justice Scalia's point is, and the obvious point is, well, in 1960 when we decriminalized gay relationships, nobody did that constitutionally. We only did that in 2003, and maybe Justice Kennedy made that up as well. So there's going to be a lot of tension on the conservative side between the consistent originalists on the one hand and those conservatives who generally like it, like Justice Kennedy might do, probably does on Commerce Clause, but certainly doesn't like it with respect to gay relationships. Look, this whole thing is starting to unravel. And one of the things about this Supreme Court analysis is there is so much attention placed upon it by so many people with so many axes to grind and harps to play that it's going to be extremely difficult to expect this thing to come out in any clean and neat fashion.
I want to latch on to, you just referenced 2003, which of course was a reference to the Lawrence case, which struck down sodomy laws. And you advanced an interesting theory recently, which is that the dissent from Justice Scalia in that case actually could create a blueprint for a majority decision legalizing gay marriage. Explain how that would work.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not the only one who has said this. I think in the post that you're referring to on ricochet.com, I noted that was also stated by Jeff Toobin, and I believe Mark Tushnet has stated a similar kind of thing on one of his Harvard blogs. But what Justice Scalia did with relentless relentless force, I think, said, look, you are raising the sexual relations of gay couples to such a high pedestal, and you're saying that anybody who thinks that there's anything the slightest bit wrong with all of this stuff is, in fact, almost a bigot. And so how can you then turn around and say that the reason you're decriminalizing this is because it stands on the same lofty plane as any other kind of sexual arrangement and then deny gay marriage? Now, he could have written a different opinion. And so the way in which you put it is Justice Kennedy squared, or Kennedy, the square root, says, look, whenever you wish to criminalize something, you have to enforce it. And the enforcement is, in fact, an ugly process. And what we do is we think that given the amount of sentiment on this issue being so divided in this country, to have these intrusive searches and seizures and criminal trials and so forth is to put people in an impossible position. So we therefore withdraw the protection of the criminal law, because we don't want to have the kinds of, you know, stomach gut wrenching type of operations to enforce it. But on the other hand, it's really easy to enforce a ban against gay marriage. You don't issue a license. You don't have to go into people's bedrooms. You don't have to punish them. You don't have to criminalize them. You just simply say, we're not going to do it. So if he'd given that sort of more functional, instrumentalist, cautious defense, he would have had a much stronger line to stand on. But you go back and you read what he said, and essentially his position is this. What you guys back in 1868 defined as a meretricious relationship, we now defined as a transcendental one. That's clearly a very powerful difference in perceptions. And once you commit yourself to that, I think you have to go the whole nine yards and essentially come out the other way. And so what many of the liberals are saying is Justice Scalia gave us our roadmap, and I think they are probably right in so saying it. But Justice Kennedy, who now, of course, is having sober second thoughts about what he has done, all of a sudden is worried about major social changes. Well, somebody could have said, how dare we decriminalize something which has been criminalized for a year without having the slightest sense of what the long-term social consequences are going to be by this form of judicial intervention? And you could have said the same thing about cruel and unusual punishment when they start saying that it's impossible to punish people with the death penalty for childhood rape. It's an interesting argument. Whenever you want the other guy not to do something, you always say that the empirical questions turn out to be completely uncertain. And for the most part, I don't think they are. There is a piece, I think, this morning by Nelson Lund, a former student of mine at GMU, who says, we don't know what the long-term consequences are of gay marriage because this thing has only been in play for 5 to 10 years, particularly on children. All right, well, does that mean we now have to wait 50 years to do a longitudinal study before we can resolve this thing the way in which the gay rights advocates want? I don't think that's a good argument for opposing this thing. I think the best argument is the one that I made in terms of what Justice Kennedy should have said, and he didn't say it. So as you can see, there are so many false turns in this debate that there's no way anybody's going to get up to the top of the mountain without stubbing themselves on the toe in some fairly rocky outcrop. This is going to be a very difficult and contentious situation, because it's not just a yes or no bifurcated issue anymore. There are so many odds and ends that we have no idea how it will play out.
What about the federalism issues here? We've heard the argument repeatedly that one of the big drawbacks to the court's decision in Roe v. Wade was forcing the issue, freezing the issue, as it were, at the national level, rather than allowing the states to progress at their own speed and according to their own cultural sensitivities. And you could hear in some of the questions at oral argument a seeming reluctance on the behalf of the justices to insert themselves squarely in the middle of this issue, precisely because it is that contentious.
Well, there's no doubt that, for example, Justice Ginsburg, who's always sort of held to that uneasy point of view, voices these kinds of situations. But it's a very odd type difference. Remember what the abortion cases were about, of course, was mere decriminalization of this particular practice. So it's obviously a very big deal. There's nothing mere about decriminalization. And it was done, in effect, in the teeth of state laws, that is, overturning all of them, which had to do with criminal stuff. But in this particular case, the DOMA is not overturning any state laws. It is written in an exact fashion to say, we're doing two things. We're basically giving full faith and credit to the laws of one state and another state, except where there's a public policy objection in the second state, which is perfectly consistent with traditional conflicts of law issues. And on the first point, they're saying for the purposes of federal statutes, we will define marriage this particular way. And right now, of course, on all sorts of statutes for the tax purposes and securities purposes and for reporting purposes, the federal government gives a definition of what it continues to be marriage for these particular purposes. And the irony here is just so utterly staggering. You get all of the liberal groups coming forward in a situation like Obamacare saying, states' rights? What are you talking about? The 10th Amendment only applies where the Commerce Clause doesn't apply. The Commerce Clause applies everywhere, as we now know. So the 10th Amendment is essentially a truism. That was the word of Justice Stone back in 1940 or 41. So, I mean, you get that stuff and you say, wait a second, now these same guys are coming forward and announcing that the state's rights are so inherent that they could define marriage for the purposes of a federal law being administered by a federal statute. I've never heard anything like that. And who signs on to this? Of course, it's all my libertarian friends, Randy Barnett and Jonathan Adler. And when I wrote about this, I said about Jeff Toobin, you know, on the other point about Scalia, he's right, essentially, on that, although he's wrong on everything else. And my attitude about this particular brief, written by one of our foremost experts on federalism, which is Ernie Young from Duke, is these guys are right on most things, but they're wrong on this. I was asked to sign that brief, and I just thought it was wrong. I mean, my own view is I would love for all of this to go away by a prompt legislative removal, and if I were to be in the position of deciding what to do on DOMA, I think the arguments against it are probably more wrong than right, unless you're going to push the hard Kennedy line that marriage is a sacred institution, at which point the federal government can't do anything to infringe its liberty by denying you tax benefits any more than the state can. But if they repealed this statute very promptly, they would do everybody an enormous favor. The strongest argument, just to continue the point, that I think for striking these things down, both of them, is if you really treat gay marriage as a predominant social relationship in the way in which Justice Kennedy does, then you cannot use the state monopoly power to discriminate against people who have equal protection in that sense. And you cannot, if you can't ban the thing at the federal level or the state level, you can't discriminate it against it in the way in which you administer the tax laws. And that's a standard argument. States with monopoly power, when they are dealing with people with legitimate claims, cannot take away from them on the benefit side unless they're able to punish them. Once you've decided you can't punish them, then you can't deny view through the tax system or the regulatory system penalized.
Final question, sort of taking the scenario to its logical conclusion. The growing consensus is that regardless of whether the Supreme Court acts here or not, gay marriage is starting to look like a fait accompli. Public opinion's shifting dramatically on this issue. And if you don't get it through the courts, you're likely to get it from the states, albeit in a slower and a more piecemeal fashion. But all the trend lines seem to be headed in one direction. So for our purposes here, let's just assume it is a given. That does create a new batch of potential problems, at least, does it not, that have to be addressed where freedom of association is concerned?
Well, it certainly does, and let me put the point the following way. There's no question that the libertarian strand of the Republican Party has started to reassert itself. Just today I read a blog, I think it was on the Wharton site, about the 300 corporations who say, you're making us very difficult for us to do business by continuing these obsolete bans on gay marriage. And I certainly think that that kind of force, when combined with the absolutely strong Democratic support, support that's so strong that it will not be revised under any circumstances, that's enough to change the political stuff. So what I'm worried about is, in fact, the next generation of plays, which then starts to say that given the fact that this is such a sacred right, now all of a sudden we have to make sure that institutions that don't adhere to this do not share equally in the benefits that the state provides. So you don't get charitable deductions to giving money to an organization that does not recognize gay marriage, like the Catholic Church, for example. Or, in effect, what you can do is you could require these organizations to hire people who, in fact, have beliefs antithetical to their own. And at this point, my attitude, which emphasized the monopoly power of the state in blocking gay marriage, goes the other way around, and it denounces very emphatically the monopoly power of the state if it's going to force associations on people who would rather not have them. So the libertarian, I think, is actually in the right position on this one. He doesn't like barriers to voluntary association, and he doesn't like mandates for forced association. He's in favor of voluntary association and live and let live. So as a political matter, he joins the gay rights groups with respect to their insistence that the licensing power of the state not be used to block marriage or deny people tax benefits if they in fact have that kind of marriage, but turns very stoutly in the opposite direction when it comes to the issue as to whether or not this becomes a club, so as to take all those organizations that don't understand it for whatever reason and basically penalizes them. And the danger of the really soaring rhetoric of Justice Kennedy is that if it's as important as he says, and if there's no rational reason for anybody to disagree with all of this stuff, then we can ram it down their throats. And that's the importance of being of keeping aware of the traditional liberty side of this issue. We don't want, essentially, to have such exuberance on this issue that the autonomy of voluntary religious organizations with fundamentally different views are going to be threatened if gay marriage is recognized, as I think in the end it should be.
Richard Epstein, thank you as always. And a reminder to our listeners, you can find Richard's weekly column, The Libertarian, by going to hoover.org and clicking on Defining Ideas. And you can follow Richard on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. For the Hoover Institution, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.